Wildfires in western states, including California, Oregon, and Washington, have burned millions of acres this month and killed at least 27 people. They've also thrown a layer of smoke over major cities, and the haze has even reached us here in Wisconsin. The fires have become an issue on the campaign trail, too, with President Trump blaming forest management practices in western states, while Democratic candidate Joe Biden is focusing on climate change. Our next guest is an expert on fire and how humans have dealt with it for centuries. In a recent piece for the LA Times, he writes that we need to do more to be prepared for these events because, as he says, the fires are coming. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Stephen J. Pine is an emeritus professor at Arizona State University specializing in environmental history. His many books include Fire, A Brief History, and Between Two Fires, A Fire History of Contemporary America. Stephen, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you.
Can you, first of all, put this year's fires so far in context of our recent and non-recent past? How badly does this year stack up?
Well, it's certainly a historic year. I'm not sure I would call it unprecedented. I can think of historical prologues or precedents for most of the fires. What I can't imagine is having all of them at one time like this. And particularly for California, I can't imagine having 4 years of serial conflagrations like this. Traditionally, California would have a big fire, then 5 or 7 or 10 years later, they'd have another big fire season. These are just a series of rolling thunders coming through. That's changed. Whether the fires become epic, I think, depends on how California and the country respond to them.
You recently wrote a piece where you compared the spread of wildfires to that of COVID-19. Different things, of course, but talk about some of the similarities you see.
Oh, well, any analogy breaks down, but it works out pretty nicely. Like virus, fire is not alive, but it feeds on. It propagates through the living landscape, so it has a lot of those same properties. We can think of, hardening your house against embers, which is the main source of ignition. It's like wearing a mask against aerosol dispersion. Defensible space, clearing around your house, is a lot like social distancing. Getting enough good fires on the landscape, well, that's a lot like herd immunity, allowing the good fires to keep the bad fires in check. So, and it also reminds us that fire is a social problem, that whatever you do, you're still at risk, depending on what your neighbors do.
You're not going to tell us that we could prevent fires from starting altogether. You say in all of your books that they're going to happen, but that mindset, knowing they're going to happen, how does that change the way we think about and prepare for fires?
Well, just walk back a second to the analogy. There's no vaccine for fire. So the best you can hope for is a kind of flu shot. So knowing that it's going to come, we've treated it as a kind of a freak. It's an emergency. It's an odd thing. In fact, in many cases, we're living in the fire equivalent of floodplains. We know they're going to come. And with all the changes that are happening, most of which are pushing towards a more fire-friendly environment, we're going to have them more often and perhaps more savage than we've had in the past. Knowing that it's there, it's not just something that we can make go away. I would hope would argue for, taking some preventative measures. And there are all kinds of things we can do. Climate change, at some point we have to tackle that as soon as possible. But apart from that, there are lots and lots of things. Fire doesn't have a single driver. It's a reaction. It integrates everything around it. In some ways, it's like a driverless car. And that makes it complicated, but it also means that there are lots of points of intervention possible. There's not just one thing or two things we have to do. There are whole kinds of things we can do to begin tweaking how fire actually behaves on the landscape and how we interact with fire.
Talking to environmental historian Stephen J. Pine from Arizona State University, author of books including Fire, A Brief History. We're talking about our current wildfires in the United States and how to deal with them better, hopefully, in the future. Well, this is an election year. This has gotten political. I want to give a listen to each major party candidate offering their key point. First, President Trump focusing on forest and fuel management.
When trees fall down after a short period of time, about 18 months, they become very dry. They become really like a matchstick. And they get up, you know, there's no more water pouring through. And they become very, very, they just explode.
And here's former Vice President Joe Biden, who kept climate change at the center of his remarks yesterday.
Donald Trump's climate denial may not have caused these fires and record floods and record hurricanes. But if he gets a second term, these hellish events will continue to become more common, more devastating, and more deadly.
As you're saying, Stephen, there's a lot going on to create a wildfire, and it might be different from one place to another. But let's look at each of those arguments. First of all, the president elsewhere, he's argued that forests have been managed poorly. Fuel hasn't been removed. How much of a part of the story is that?
Well, one of the problems with fire is that it is so visceral and graphic that a lot of people latch onto it and the emotions it arouses to promote other agendas. And often these have very little to do with actually dealing with the fire. Because fire feeds on vegetation, the character of the vegetation is a big influence on fire and the kind of fire that occurs. But there's also a difference between biomass and fuel. And one of the things that converts biomass into fuel is the climate. So there, as in all these things with fire, there are interactions. Certainly, we've aggravated the fire scene in many places, not every place, by excluding fire and not finding some kind of surrogate for it. And this has allowed some places to overgrow and to thicken in ways that can promote more fire. It also can cause ecological deterioration, particularly places that need sunlight, patches of open sky, and become overgrown and shaded. So there are a lot of reasons, you know, that it's certainly an important part. But I think if we had the same climate we had in the 1960s with the fuel structures we have today, we would be having big fires, but they wouldn't be this ferocious and they wouldn't be this frequent.
And let's take that now to the climate change side of things. Yeah, how is that raising our risk of fires and of big fires in particular?
Well, it's acting as a performance enhancer, if you will, on pre-existing conditions. And so we may have a poor fuel situation, but the climate is making it worse. The one of the big issues, though, with climate is that unlike fuels, the fuels are dependent. You know, they're specific to a particular place, but climate issues are globalizing fire concerns. So whether you manage your local scene well or not, it's going to be subject to the same kinds of exaggerations that climate change is imposing elsewhere. So, and there are lots of other things. I mean, how we build our structure, how we build our houses and communities. Power lines are a big issue for starting fires. You can have lots of fuel and a long drought or high winds, but if you haven't got a spark, you don't have fire. There are lots and lots of ways in which fire can come together.
And that last point is one I wanted to get to next, the fire triangle, which I think I learned about in one of your books. It's the fuel, the oxidizing agent, usually oxygen, and that ignition, the thing that ignites it in the first place. Sometimes that's lightning, and we can't do much about that, I guess. But could we make a difference in the human-caused ignitions of these fires?
Well, sure, we can. About 90% of fires nationally are set by humans. The larger fraction of lightning fires are set in the West, the interior West, the Rocky Mountains, and part of Central Florida, interestingly enough. But otherwise, these are things we do directly or deliberately or indirectly, say with power lines, catalytic converters on our vehicles that we then drive over dry grass. There are all kinds of ways we start. And interesting study has been done very recently looking at the climatic effects that we're seeing, particularly the lengthening of the spring dry period, and that makes it possible for fire season to expand, but that does, it isn't bringing fires. What we have are people igniting fires in that new condition. So it's the interaction of the two that is actually expanding the fire season. And many, many of our most disastrous fires have been started by machinery, by power lines, by abandoned campfires, in effect, by humans. Lightning fires tend to be in more remote areas, public lands, so they tend not to threaten communities in the same way.
We continue our conversation about wildfires with Stephen Pine, Emeritus Professor at Arizona State and an expert on wildfire history and management. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about how and why wildfires start and or spread, or about the ways we try to contain them, to prevent them, to mitigate them? Do you think we need to change the approach that we take to wildfires in the future? If you have questions about climate change, forest management, anything related to this, you could join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hi.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. My question is, I'm wondering if we have any math formulated yet to give us an idea of how many metric tons of carbon and CO2 have been released by these current forest fires.
Interesting, Stephen. Well, are forest fires a significant contributor to carbon emissions?
Yes and no. There's a difference between the kinds of fires we're seeing now and sort of prescribed or controlled burning, which basically operates on the surface, typically operates on the surface, and so all the stuff is recovered. And that's also true for forests in general, that eventually they rebuild, the carbon is restored. That's a big difference than, say, draining and burning off peat in Indonesia or clearing the Amazon and burning, or fossil fuels, where you're taking stuff that's in deep storage or long-term storage and then releasing it. So forest fires can produce a dramatic impulse of released carbon, but generally they tend to be conservative in the sense that the landscape recovers. But part of the unknowns about our current situation is that with climate change and other things going on, we don't know what will come back exactly. So there could be a net transfer as well.
Thanks a lot for that call, Mike, at 800-642-1234. I want to get a little more into the idea of keeping us humans from creating the spark that creates the fire, especially when conditions are ripe. What kind of practical changes? Does this mean we put power lines in different places or take better care of the strip of land on either side of a power line? What are some practical things we can do to prevent that spark hitting the fuel?
Well, there are lots of things you can do. There may be some selective burial. I think of a lot of places in California where we know where the winds are going to go. These are sort of fire floodplains. If you're upwind of a town, then that's a good place to bury it. Other places, you may have a more a smarter grid where you can route, you can turn it off selectively and reroute power other places. This may be a good argument for solar or renewables where it's locally stored, so you can have power lines shut down and still have power where you need it. California is getting some of the most notorious episodes of this, but the largest wildfire in New Mexico history was started by power lines. The fire outside Austin, Texas, Bastrop County, was started by power lines. Gatlinburg, Tennessee, burned a few years ago, and that was all started from power lines. So it's really a national issue, and we've needed to rebuild our grid for a long time anyway, and we could certainly build in fire protection as part of that.
Let's take a comment from Mary in Madison, who called in, says she heard that people whose houses burned down would simply rebuild on the same site. Mary asks, why haven't zoning laws been changed to prevent people from building in spots that are prone to fires? Is that part of the story, some kind of fire-related zoning, Stephen?
Well, that's part of it. There's certainly a lot of discussion going on about mapping places of high hazard, very similar to problems in earthquake zones or river floodplains or coastal. And then, you know, it's very hard to tell Americans they can't build where they want. And we build in all those places. And so it's difficult to say, because of fire, you're not going to be allowed to rebuild in the same way. In fact, well, people do rebuild, and mostly we cheer them on. You know, they're thrown off the horse, they're getting back on. They're showing some pluck, determination. They're going to go through this hard time. They're going to rebuild, and they're going to reestablish their lives again. But there are also social costs to that, and they may be at risk again. And this has happened. There was an old joke many years ago. It was produced in California and showed a series of comparative slides, one showing a chaparral that's burned and then regrowing. And next to it was a community. It's kind of macabre humor. And then it's burned, and then they show it rebuilding, beginning with the, you know, frame house and the rest of it. And there's a certain sense in which that's true, but it's also, it's not just restricted to fire.
Right.
And we've had a problem.
Ask, if I have tens of millions of dollars and want to build a building in San Francisco, I have to put in certain earthquake type constructions. Are there things like that, whether it's in the construction itself or the gaps in vegetation or whatever, are there things like earthquake mitigation that we can do for construction for fire mitigation?
Yes. And in fact, we've been doing it for a long time for cities. I mean, that our cities used to burn as often as the surrounding countryside. So they were made of the same materials, but we stopped. And it wasn't just because we have fire engines and hydrants. It's because we have building codes and standards and zoning. But the problem is when we get into these rural or in many cases, ex-urban communities, we haven't defined them as urban. We think of this as a rural or a wildland fire problem with houses in it. In many respects, it makes more sense to think of it as a little bits of cities with funny landscaping. And if you did that, then you would automatically begin applying all of these standards that we have developed over a long period of time to protect cities from being destroyed by fires.
Reading your LA Times piece, Stephen, I feel like I get a little sense of frustration that we get real excited about wildfires when they're happening. But if we'd done some stuff over the last, I don't know, 20 years, these wildfires might not be so bad now. What kind of things do we need to be doing even when the wildfire isn't on the TV screen?
It's very hard to get interest in fire unless it's news. It's like a fever, then it breaks, and then it's gone. There are a lot of things about getting our communities ready for the next fire and hardening them against embers. Embers are the main point of vulnerability. So it's not that fires come through like a tsunami of flame. They come through like a swarm of flaming locusts. So we understand that, and we can target that. We can also do better stuff around the surrounding environments, maybe think about green belts of various kinds. And we can be thinking about our wildlands, how to get a better fire-resilient landscape there. They will continue to burn, but they may not burn quite as savagely. And it may be easier to stop those fires when they come. So there are lots of things. This is not something new. We don't need a crash program in fire science. We've known about this stuff for a long time. And there's a whole reservoir of traditional knowledge that was suppressed and needs to be recovered as well. You know, humans have lived with fire all of our existence as a species. We're a species monopolist for fire. We're the keystone species for fire. It's only in the last century or two when we really converted to fossil fuels that we forgot how to live with fire in living landscapes.
In our last few moments, I know you early in your career worked on fire crews. What are your thoughts right now, what we should be thinking about for the people stretched thin right now fighting these fires?
Well, we should be thinking that firefighter safety counts, and we should not be putting people at risk for circumstances where they really can't make a difference. We need to be selective in where we apply our force, where we are willing to commit firefighters. The job can be dangerous. It doesn't have to be lethal. We We should be responsible and not expect, you know, we've created in places like California where you have a nature that's given, built to burn and explosively burn. And we've got a society that wants to build where and when it wants to. And we've had our fire crews standing between as a buffer. And I think we've reached the point where we can't do that anymore. It just isn't physically possible. And it isn't, in a sense, morally responsible to ask them to do that. We have to stand up and begin managing fire smartly. And we have to design our communities for the fact that fires are going to come.
Stephen, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
My pleasure. Have a good one.
You too. That's Stephen J. Pine, emeritus professor at Arizona State University, specializing in environmental history. He's written a lot of books about fire, including Fire, A Brief History. We talked to him about the wildfires in the western U.S. now and how we can rethink fire management in the future.